Only smart people get up early enough to listen to the Francine Marie Show. So thanks for listening, smarty pants.
Good morning, campers! Pick up your coffee cup, make a cup of tea, pour yourself a beer. Hair of the dog, it's the Francine Marie Show!
Good morning. Thanks for joining us. If racial discrimination is passed down from generation to generation and policymaker to policymaker, then shuffled into law agencies, courtrooms, schools, and banks, what position can African Americans take to rewrite the wrongs in their American history story? Well, reparations has worked in the past to right some wrongs. How do you eliminate the racial wealth gap in America? What does the Black Code mean? What is the roadmap? Ladies and gentlemen, we've got the answers because we have a new best friend. Joining us today is the author of From Here to Equality. It's William Darity, also known as Sandy. He is a economist, researcher. He is also has a beautiful wife by the name of Kristen Mullen, who co-wrote the book. William Darity is the professor at Duke University. I could go on for days and hours. Good morning. How are you?
Fine, thank you. Thanks for having me on your program.
This is some really story and situation that you're bringing into the forefront during a COVID pandemic situation, and we're listening. Are we listening now more in 2020 than we did before?
I think people began to listen more in 2019, particularly when we actually had credible political candidates who would utter the term reparations. I'd never heard that ever on the national stage before last year, but I think that people are listening even more intently now in the environment of the coronavirus crisis, and also the long overdue recognition by many Americans, as well as people around the world, that the Black community in the United States has been confronted with long, long passages of anti-Black police violence. Mm-hmm. So I think in a sense, it's been a tragic set of circumstances that have brought people's attention and focus more strongly onto the issue of reparations for Black American descendants of U.S. slavery. And so it's unfortunate in that, but it's been long overdue for people to pay attention to anti-Black police violence and to recognize that there is a need for restitution to be directed at the Black community, merited by the Black community as a consequence of the history of the nation's trajectory of racial injustice.
Right. And it does boil down to those two words, racial injustice, because some people I've seen on the other side would say, well, slavery's been, 100 years? What are you talking about? Get over it. As if it was some kind of, you know, the measles where it lasted a week. No, this lasted generations. So it's about catching up, right? Reparations is about catching up and healing. Would those be two words you would use for it?
Yes, I think those are absolutely appropriate words to use. It's catching up, it's healing, it's creating the material conditions for Black Americans whose ancestors were enslaved in the United States to have full citizenship in this country. That is something that has been consistently denied Black Americans, even in the aftermath of the passage of the 14th Amendment. We have had, in a sense, what some people call a crippled or disabled citizenship from the time of the formation of the Republic in 1776. And that is something that a plan for reparations should reverse and make it possible for Black Americans to fully engage in the life of this society with the same array of opportunities that are available to other Americans.
Mm. Let me skip to something and I'll come right back. The Constitution of the United States, was it really written for the betterment of African Americans, their lives, their life condition? Some people call them forefathers who wrote that thing. Some of us call us those racist dudes. Was the Constitution really, it didn't have us in mind as African Americans, did it?
It certainly had us in mind, but it had us in mind, again, in the context of a disabled citizenship. You know, the compromise over the way in which enslaved people would be counted, and the enslaved people were virtually all persons of African origin or near African origin at that point in 1789 when the Constitution was adopted, that there was an inclusion, but it was an inclusion that was in a kind of a perverse form. Enslaved individuals were going to be counted as 3/5 of a person. Frequently, I think people think of that as an act of denigration of enslaved folks, but in a twisted way, 3/5 was better than counting enslaved people as a full person because they were not going to be able to vote, but they were to be counted in terms of determining congressional apportionment on behalf of the slaveholding state. And so if enslaved black people had been counted as a full person, the slaveholding states would have had even greater representation than they actually had. But with the 3/5 count, they still had sufficient representation to be the dominant political force in this country up until the Civil War.
While slavery was a very evil, diabolical plan that's still in force, why does it have so much power to control? Because the people that are controlling, created, and implementing the diabolical plan? We're just wondering, why is it still here?
I'm not sure in what sense you're saying slavery continues. Although, the crippled citizenship of Black Americans has continued. In the aftermath of the Civil War, for example, the formerly enslaved were promised 40-acre land grant as restitution, and that promise was not fulfilled. But at the same time, about 1.5 million white American families received 160-acre land grants in the western part of the United States, territories that had been appropriated from the native population. And that provided them with the foundation for economic security and wealth that could be transmitted across the generation. And such a transition took place to the degree that it is now estimated by a researcher named Trina Shanks Williams that approximately 45 million living white Americans are beneficiaries of the land grants that took place, those 160-acre land grants that took place under the terms of the Homestead Act. So on the one hand, the newly emancipated people received absolutely nothing in the form of restitution for their years of bondage. A significant number of white Americans, including recent or new immigrants at the time, between 1862 and 1938, received these substantial grants of tracts of land in the western part of the United States. So that's the beginning of what I would like to refer to as the racial wealth chasm. The chasm is so large today that the average black household in the United States has a net worth that is $800,000 less than the average white household. Another statistic that's related to that condition is the fact that black Americans who had enslaved ancestors in the United States constitute about 13% of the nation's population, but this is a community that only has about 2.5% of the nation's wealth. So I'm not sure about the notion that slavery was offended, but certainly the practices of white supremacy were offended to the present day.
Right. So the only thing I can think of, I skip parts of history and just go, oh, there it is again. When I say slavery these days, I look at the industrialized prison system and I'm like, that's it. That's the new form of it. I'll have you work for free or for pennies. I'll charge you while you're here, knowing you can't pay your bill when you leave. I'm going to make it so you can't live anyplace decent. So I see that as that new slavery, if you were to pop it up in the 2000s, which started way before 2000s.
I will absolutely agree with that. I think that's very insightful. I think some people refer to that phenomenon as neo-slavery, and it is apparent in the aftermath of the Civil War in a number of forms. One of those forms is the provisions of the Black Code, which were introduced for the purposes of managing, containing, and controlling the lives of the newly emancipated in such a way that you more or less restored slave-like conditions. These codes dictated that individual Black Americans did not have the supervisory power or the protective power over their own children, that their children could be apprenticed, in quote, without their approval, without their decision. It also meant that there was absolute control that was going to be exercised over what type of employment the newly emancipated folks were, and there were provisions that prevented them from leaving jobs at their own volition. And so the Black Codes actually were a way of attempting to restore slavery-like conditions. And then we move into the convict leasing system, as well as now the phenomenon of mass incarceration. And of course, as many people have pointed out, the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, which calls for an end to slavery, has an exception clause that slavery-like conditions can be conducted or maintained legally for individuals who have been convicted of crime.
All you can do is just shake your head. When you're doing your research, do you ever just get overwhelmed as in, oh, right? Men don't scream, but if what kind of feelings and sentiments do you have when you did your research and as you continue?
Well, I'm not sure how I've managed to insulate myself from these types of emotions. You know, I think when I first started working on the history of enslavement in the United States, and also I did a substantial amount of work on enslavement and its relationship to economic development in Europe, enslavement that took place in the Caribbean primarily. I think I did, you know, find myself occasionally welling up, but the longer that I've worked on it, I think I've developed more of a sense of determination that we need to rectify or correct this situation, and we need to engage in the types of policies, transformative policies, that will actually change America and make America a country that is truly democratic for the very first time. So I feel differently about it now in terms of not being so overcome by reading about and learning about these atrocities. I think it also helped that, you know, Kirsten Mullen and I have been able to collaborate on this research so that, in some sense, we can bolster one another.
Right, right.
In trying to deal with this very hard material.
Right. As you plant this garden of beautifulness, right, together. And I think that's such a great love story, right, for you and Kirsten to work on this book, to have the same goals and to, you know, get up every morning and go, you know what? I got some more stuff to do. Yeah, I got some more stuff to do. So, okay. So before I get into the roadmap to reparations for African Americans, I do have to ask you, who's studying under you? Do you have any folks that are, I know you're at Duke University, so you have a plethora of folks to choose from to work with. Do you need more people in this field of study to continue your work?
Oh, absolutely. I wish that we had a large cadre of researchers who were committed to the project of doing serious scholarly investigation that would support the cause of reparations for Black American descendants of U.S. slavery. What is in place is a group that we refer to as the Reparations Planning Committee, which is a collective of scholars who are involved in a project where we are trying to fully flesh out how you might execute a reparations plan. In the final chapter of our book, Kirsten Mullen and I present a plan for reparations, but it is not fully developed or adequately developed, and so as a consequence, I work to try to put together this group that will produce a report on how you might do reparations in a very comprehensive way. But it would be exciting to have even more scholars join this effort in some way, shape, or form. That's a great question.
So I could definitely say to our listeners, you want to be a scholar, you want to be an ambassador, you want to learn more about this history, you just need to Google this name and it will pop up 150,000 things. It is William Darity, also known as Sandy. He is an economist and a researcher. He is a professor at Duke University. He is all that. and so much more. And I'm so glad you're with us today because you've got the roadmap. So if we had a roadmap, and just so I can definitely tell folks that this has been done before. People have got, I don't know if they called them reparations, but they've called it ascendant programs. We got the Japanese, the Holocaust, the apartheid, North Carolina to compensate victims of its forced sterilization programs in the mid-20th century, right? So the government knows how to give people money. It's just the fact that, will you do it?
Well, and will you do it for people who are Black Americans? Yes. I mean, there's the other kinds of projects that you're describing, especially the German government's payments to victims of the Holocaust and the U.S. government's payments to Japanese Americans who were unjustly incarcerated during World War II. Those were explicitly labeled as reparations. So we do have a number of precedents in the work that Kirsten and I have been doing since our book was published. We've also paid some attention to the federal government's reparations payments to families that lost loved ones in the course of 9/11. And what's particularly striking about that example is the United States government was not the culpable party in that instance, although it's definitely the culpable party with respect to the Japanese-American internment. And the U.S. government is the culpable party with respect to the trajectory of racial injustice that's been executed against Black Americans. But yeah, we have precedent. This is how it's been done in the past, and it's been done primarily by making direct payments to the eligible recipients, members of the victimized community. So, you know, our thinking is it should be no different with respect to reparations for Black American descendants of U.S. slavery. One of the critical components of the plan must be direct payments to eligible recipients. Now, we have a very precise set of standards that we attempt to deploy for purposes of defining or identifying who would be eligible to receive reparations. And there are two criteria.
Okay.
The first is what we refer to as a lineage standard. An individual would have to demonstrate that they have at least one ancestor who was enslaved in the United States of America. And then the second is what we refer to as an identity standard. And this is a condition where an individual would have to demonstrate through using some form of legal documentation that for at least 12 years before the enactment of a reparations plan or the enactment of a study commission for reparations, that they self-identified as Black, Negro, Afro-American, or African-American. And so if somebody meets those two conditions, then they would be eligible for the receipt of reparations. We contend that probably upwards of about 40 million Americans would be eligible to receive reparations under those conditions. And we also estimate that the total amount of funds that would be required to successfully eliminate racial wealth differences in the United States, which is what we think is a primary target of the reparations plan, would be approximately $10 to $12
trillion. $10 to $12 trillion. Wow. If you broke that down person to person, and I know it's variables and all that good math that you guys do, but would that be $1 million per African-American person? Would it be 800,000?
No, it would be close to $1 million per household, but on an individual basis, it would be somewhere in the vicinity of $250,000 to $300,000.
Okay. Which ain't bad, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Let me add, the $10 to $12 trillion estimate, a number of people have said it's too low and have argued for higher amounts. And I don't have any aversion to higher up.
Yeah. Wow. Oh, man. Give us the money. Show us the money. But, so President Barack Obama, right? I was just amazed that he said, no, we don't need reparations. We're good. I know, he didn't say it that way, but that's how I received it.
Clearly, he was clearly Barack Obama was opposed to reparations. That's one of, in my estimation, that's one of the one of the great tragedies of this presidency. The first recognized black president was actually somebody who publicly stood in opposition to reparations, black American descendants of U.S. slavery. You know, that was a sad moment.
Yeah, that was a blow. That was a blow, Obama. Come on now. And then you never know what really happens in politics, right? We have no clue on the outside. Like, are they, you know, like, if you say that, we're going to shoot you like we did Martin Luther King. We don't know that, but who knows? On a happier...
Wow.
Yeah, right, because he had to walk past his casket on that Air Force One, right? That's kind of
Let me say this. There was an intermediate step that he could have advocated, I think, without it being as dramatic as endorsing reparations, which is to say that he might have said he was in favor of a commission to examine the question, or he could have appointed a commission himself to examine the question. The legislation that exists today is for a congressional commission to study reparations, but the president of the United States can appoint any commission at any time that they might desire. So there was nothing that was prohibiting Barack Obama. There's nothing that was prohibiting his successors or his predecessors from appointing a commission to investigate and explore the question of reparations for black American descendants of U.S. slavery. And that would have come up short of making an endorsement and might have been, in some sense, a politically safer step to take. But the step that he actually took was to be an outright opponent.
Has there been a president yet to just be kind of just open to the fact of reparations? I know they watch their wording and they position themselves and then they pivot themselves with statements. I didn't really say that. I said it like, is Biden, Harris? I mean, has anybody said these words?
Well, I'm not sure that anybody who's reached the stage of actually being a candidate of either one of the major parties has made such a commitment. I don't believe anyone ever has.
Okay.
Since Lincoln's assassination, because at the end of Lincoln's life, he was fully supportive of the provision of the 40-acre land grant to the formerly enslaved. I don't believe that there's been any other American president since then who has actually supported an effort for redress for black American descendants of U.S. slavery. Clearly, that has not been the case for the Biden-Harris ticket. And, of course, as we would not be surprised to recognize that there's no reason to expect President Trump to have any enthusiasm for reparations.
Right. Well, at least he keeps us awake and aware. You know, I do give him like that a little bit of credit there. He will wake you up as an American, right? A lot of politicians will put you to sleep while they're in office, but this dude, no, he's gonna wake you up in the middle of the night.
never a dull moment.
It isn't. And we have a new best friend this morning. I'm hoping I can keep him on just a little bit longer. It is our professor at Duke University. It is William Darity, also known as Sandy, economist and researcher, married to the beautiful wife who he's co-authored this book with, Kristen Mullen. And the book is, you know, it's about... the book is about reparations. The book is the roadmap. And if I can get you for a little bit longer, what are some steps we could take? How can we help you help us? Oh, that's a good one, right? How can we help you help us?
Well, there's a number of steps that could be taken, but I think that a critical step is for a coalition to be formed that would lobby and petition Congress actively for reparations for black American descendants of U.S. slavery. And originally, I think Kirsten and I imagined that colleges and universities, particularly those who have a history of complicity with slavery, would take the lead in the formation of such a coalition. but it seems apparent that it's more likely that some of our municipal governments throughout the United States will take such a lead. In fact, our own city of Durham, our own city council, recently passed a resolution committing Durham to support the effort for a comprehensive national plan for reparations. And so if other cities would join with Durham for that cause, that would be a terrific beginning. But the other thing that I think individuals, organizations, businesses, colleges and universities, local governments must do is to get their own house in order, which is a little bit different from the provision of reparations. There's a remarkable quotation from Malcolm X where he makes the distinction between pulling the knife out of the back of somebody who is stabbed and healing the wound, which is the language that you used earlier in the program. And from our perspective, pulling the knife out is essential, which it means ending the harm, stopping the damage from continuing. Mm-hmm. But healing the wound requires compensation or restitution for the harms that have taken place, and that is what is reparation. We need both. We need to pull the knife out, and we need to heal the wound. But I think that many, many organizations, individuals, families, and the like have not addressed the question of pulling the knife out, stopping the damages, stopping the harms that they themselves might be causing or their organizations might be causing. And I think that that's another essential step. So there are the two. One is to support a congressional approval of a program for reparations. And the second is to make sure that your own life and organization is in order with respect to maintaining conditions of racial equity.
Right, because we gotta fill that gap. That wealth gap is no joke. I mean, we love some Amazon, but Mr. Bezos, really? Can you share a little bit? Or maybe that's the thing. Rich people share. Okay, forget about it.
Well, yes, except that won't do it necessarily. So there are a number of issues here. So let me try to give you a sense of the scope of what is required and why it must be predominantly action that's taken by the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
If all of the states and municipalities throughout the United States made a commitment to finance reparations, they would do that in a context in which their total annual expenditures are about $3.1 trillion. And that's their budgeted expenditures for all purposes. So let's imagine in a hypothetical situation that somehow they could transfer all of that to a reparations project. Well, it would still fall at least $7 trillion short of the amount that would be required to eliminate the racial wealth differential.
Okay.
And it's really only the federal government among our nation's governmental units that has the capacity to amass that level of funds to address the racial wealth gap. But also, it's the federal government that's the culpable party. You know, we can talk at length about businesses and universities that engage in the slave trade and slavery in the United States. But the paradoxical condition is, although what they were doing was immoral, it was not illegal.
Yeah.
And so it's the federal government that bears the legal and authority responsibility for what has occurred in the United States. And it is the federal government that has the obligation to meet the debt, an obligation that is not a matter of individual or personal guilt. It's a matter of an essential national action.
Right. I just think it's bizarre and so strange that we have "In God We Trust" on the dollar bill, right? When we don't push religion down your throat. No, you can do anything you want. I just think there's so many oxymorons in the United States of America, right? Sometimes you can call us a bully, sometimes not. Will it be compassionate enough? They have acknowledged that, you know, we're so sorry that that slavery thing happened, right? They have said, oh, we're so sorry. But that doesn't heal you. It doesn't work.
At the beginning of our book, we describe or define reparations as a program of acknowledgement, redress, and closure for a grievous injustice.
Grievous.
And the second step, redress, is absolutely critical. We don't view acknowledgement alone as sufficient, although it's definitely desirable. By acknowledgement, we mean that the culpable party recognizes that it has committed a deep harm and simultaneously agrees to engage in an act of restitution. And historically, the restitution has typically involve direct payments to eligible recipients. And so that's the form that redress should take. But there's a third component that I should mention, which is closure. And what does closure mean in the context of our discussion? It means that the victimized party or the victimized community will make no further claims on the culpable party for restitution after redress has been satisfactorily administered. And they'll make no further claims unless there's a renewal of the atrocity or there's a new set or type of atrocities that takes place. But in the absence of that, the debt would be paid and the claim would be settled.
The debt paid. I love it. Right, because you got to have closure. I mean, think of it like a relationship, just husband and wife or whatever, and you're just, you know, you can't get abused in it and just keep walking on. You know, the party has to apologize, restitution has to be made, then we can move on, right? That's how we're programmed. At least I hope that happens. Yeah.
I've always said, you know, that there can be no conciliation without reparations.
Exactly. Reparations Planning Committee. All right. William Darity. Oh, I have to ask you, we went through this whole interview. Why the nickname Sandy?
So my full name is William Alexander Darity Jr. So I was named after my father. And he was known as Bill. And my mother did not want me to be called Little Bill. So she used my middle name, Alexander. And she extracted Sandy from it somehow. And so I've been Sandy since I was a small child.
Oh, and you've always been smart, right? You've always been smart. You've always been scholarly. You could just tell. Some people were born to do this work.
I don't know about that, but I've always been curious. Let me say that.
Well, we love it. And will you come back and talk to us some more? It's just time flies when you're talking about equality, right? We're talking to the author of the book, From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century. He wrote the book with his wife, the amazing Kristen Mullen. Thank you so much for doing what you do.
Thank you. Thanks so much for talking to me.
Well, your 1 hour of public talk radio is up. I don't know where the time goes when you're having fun. I am your hostess of the mostest, Francine Marie. Until we meet, and one day we will, I want you to have a good week. Bye-bye, everybody.
Thank you for joining us for the Francine Marie Show, where we address issues concerning you and your family.
That's all for now. See you next week.
Please, please do not harm us. We have come to your planet for one thing, the Francine Marie Show. It's the only content we can digest.